This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is global warming unstoppable now? Could we be saved by total economic collapse? If so, should we help civilization fall?
I think that undermining or sabotaging the economic growth machine is a fundamentally good thing.
It's another cheery edition of Radio EcoShock, with your darkness at the end of the tunnel, Alex Smith. Last night, I recorded another glimpse of the climate apocalypse with the author of Climate Wars, Gwyn Dyer. He outlined the short distance from here to the cliff where long-known natural feedbacks leading to runaway global warming start out and continue on for millennia. That limit is known as 2 degrees. Beyond that, great forests melt into fire, liberating their carbon. Beyond that, the Arctic permafrost melts, likely doubling atmospheric greenhouse gases at least. 5 to 7 degrees centigrade of average global temperature rise, utter disaster. Dyer says world governments quickly agreed to the 2-degree limit at Copenhagen without telling the public why. No need to panic the herd. He says we won't make it in time before the big climate switch is pulled. You'll hear clips from that speech in an upcoming EcoShock show. Rising up early this morning, I tune into a climate science webcast from the Center for American Progress. Two top American IPCC scientists, trying not to say too much. Later in this program, I'll have a few clips and comments from that update, hosted by Joe Rome of the blog climateprogress.org. But we'll start out with a very different sort of scientist. Cloud specialist Tim Garrett stepped in a few people's faces when he proposed a formula about carbon and the world's wealth. Simply put, unless our economy collapses to levels that you and I would hate, climate change is unstoppable. Garrett bases his jarring statements on a basic law of physics, of thermodynamics. You won't need a science degree to understand our Radio EcoShock interview. Following Garrett, we dive deeper into the culture of despair. Keith Farnish is the author of Time's Up, An Uncivilized Solution to a Global Crisis. Are you ready to become uncivilized? If collapse is the best solution, would you help kick the system over? Or would you just watch it fall? Farnish has been called a terrorist and a green realist. Your brain exercise for troubling times coming up. But let's start with the science of collapse. Maybe energy conservation isn't enough. What if global warming is already an unstoppable force? Is economic collapse one of our only hopes? These disturbing questions arise in a controversial study by Tim Garrett, an associate professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah. Tim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Hi. Well, can you give us the title of your new paper and where people can find it?
The title of the paper is, Are There Basic Physical Constraints on Carbon Dioxide Emissions? And the article can be found on my website, perhaps most easily, which is easily found by either Googling Tim Garrett or going to the Atmospheric Sciences page at the University of Utah, or it can be found through the journal Climatic Change.
Okay, and I'll toss in a link to your webpage in my blog for this program. Well, look, I understand you applied some basic physics to the way our civilization works. Can you explain your theory for us?
Sure. I think the concept is easily understood in the light of perhaps looking at a growing child. And this is a familiar analogy, perhaps a good place to start, because if we think about a growing child, a child consumes energy, as does an adult, in order to maintain daily operations of that child. But what is a bit different with a child is that as the child uses the energy, it uses energy not only to maintain its current size, but also uses some fraction of that energy in order to grow its current size. And if it does that efficiently, then it is able to grow faster and thereby consume more energy rather than less energy in the future. And it's a very simple physical concept. It can be written down with basic thermodynamic arguments using equations. But as I showed, it can also be applied to civilization as a whole, treating civilization as being an energy-consuming organism. And if that is done, then it turns out that there is a very simple relationship between the rate of energy consumption by civilization as a whole and its economic value. It turns out that money is power, where power is the rate of energy consumption. There is a simple relationship of about 10 milliwatts per inflation-adjusted $1990 dollar. And that's really the key result, I think, that leads to the other results that I found in the paper.
And one of those was a suggestion that alternative energy like solar may not actually help stop climate change. And I've heard those doubts from other scientists and from an economist like Britain's Tim Jackson. So growth, even green technology, could just mean more energy is consumed. Is that right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the green technology, I think, is a slightly separate issue from the growth itself. The society will consume energy and probably try to maximize its growth regardless, whether it's green technology or not green technology. Perhaps the difference between green technologies and other types is that some of these green technologies aren't associated with carbon dioxide emissions. But as I pointed out, in order just to stabilize carbon dioxide emissions, just as we might talk about stabilizing carbon dioxide emissions in a growing human being, because we all breathe out carbon dioxide, the switch to non-CO2-emitting power sources would have to be very rapid, about 2.2% per year. So that works out to, just as an easy metric, one nuclear power plant per day.
Wow. Well, I don't think we're about to build a nuclear power plant per day, so we'll get in just a few minutes, I think, to what the other alternative could be. But I wanted first to raise the question, to everyone's surprise, you've said that we don't even need to calculate population growth or even the spread of higher living standard to know how things will go, that this energy is the key factor. That seems a bit hard to believe.
Yeah, it might seem hard to believe, but I mean, it's not that standard of living and population aren't part of the energy consumption by civilization. Obviously, people consume energy in commensurate to their standard of living. But the point is that our standard of living and how many people there are on the planet is really just a consequence of past energy efficiency. So, to think about it another way, coming back to the growing child, I don't need to think about the cells, the number of cells in the child, or how much energy each cell consumes to know that the child will grow. And I can look at how much energy the child is consuming to get an idea of how fast the child will continue to grow. I don't need to know the details.
I understand. Well, you've also described civilization as a heat engine. Could you enlarge on that?
Well, I think that's the basic idea. A heat engine is, well, it's a very familiar concept in thermodynamics or in physics. Everyone learns about it in their physics degree, if that's the path they take. And normally a heat engine was, well, the idea was first coined in the 1800s when people were thinking about digging up coal or whatever it was. And you pop coal into an engine, and then it would do mechanical work to lift something or move something. In the case of civilization, we aren't trying to lift some external object. When we consume energy to do work for ourselves. So it's a slightly different heat engine than is a normal conception. Here there's a feedback loop. If we consume energy and do work with that energy, that work is done to enable us to consume more energy in the future. So there's a feedback that leads to growth in this situation, rather than just simply work being done on some external agency.
And meanwhile, our politicians continue to call us back to a growing GDP. That sounds like our carbon emissions will never really go down if that happens.
Well, in fact, if it's a growing GDP, that not only corresponds to accelerating growth of carbon dioxide emissions, but actually an interesting mathematical form, which is a super exponential growth. So it's not just exponential growth, but it is the exponent of an exponent. So emissions are not only accelerating, but the rate of growth is accelerating as well. And that's just an unavoidable consequence of a growing GDP.
And that's pretty believable when we hear about what's happening in China and India and all around the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's always a constant surprise. You see reports where the people who are measuring the CO2 are constantly surprised that CO2 emissions rates have continued to accelerate even when the scientists are hearing dire economic forecasts.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist Tim Garrett from the University of Utah, and we're about to explore whether economic collapse is the best way to save the biosphere, because we've talked about nuclear power. We need a new atomic plant every day, and that doesn't seem likely in time to avert catastrophic climate disruption, in my opinion. So that leaves economic collapse, and some deep greens, as you know, Tim, have called for this, but you're among the first academics that I know of to publish a peer-reviewed paper saying collapse may be necessary to save a habitable planet. Or am I putting words in your mouth? Maybe you didn't say quite that.
Well, not quite that, but that's what I did say, is that if we are to ever stabilize emissions, that necessitates unpalatable, let's say, economic implications. If we are just to stabilize emissions, and I think this is a bit counterintuitive at first, but if we were just to stabilize the emissions, not so that they're decreasing, but just to stabilize them, the economy would have to be zero, adjusted for inflation. That does not mean that there wouldn't be economic activities going on, simply that none of these economic activities would add to the value of civilization. They would always be compensated for by some inflationary pressure. Now, I don't know what that world would look like. I've never lived in a world like that, but perhaps we can imagine by looking at some recent situations in places like Zimbabwe, where they ended up with hyperinflation, and it was a very different sort of life than we are used to ourselves in North America.
And so you looked at past development of civilization and applied your formula. Can you take the same formula and try and measure out how deep and how bad this collapse would have to be? I guess you've sort of expressed it right now, but could you enlarge on that, on what it would take to bring our carbon back to, say, 350? Can we figure that out?
Wow, I did run this once, and with some extremely drastic scenarios, I was able to see the model settle out at about 450 parts per million. But that would mean virtual complete economic collapse within my lifetime. I cannot imagine how it would be possible to get down to 350 parts per million. It seems implausible.
I gather it was hard to get this paper published until it came out in late 2009. What has been the reaction so far?
Well, the reaction I've got has been, there's been a fair bit of interest from people, interestingly enough, who are proponents of the peak oil theory. So for the peak oil fans, of course, finding some sort of basic link between the economy and rates of energy consumption is a very useful thing, because then they can relate it to their own understanding of the size and depletion rates of geological reservoirs of oil. And so, you know, that's heartening. I mean, it's nice to have when someone's interested in it. And other colleagues have found some interest, too, in just the basic thermodynamic framework.
But nobody's been too negative about it?
No, not at all. In fact, all the response I've got has been encouraging. I think a lot of people have long had a suspicion that statements that increasing energy efficiency will lead to reduced energy consumption something's quite obviously wrong with that, because it runs counter to our experience. We've been increasing energy efficiency throughout history. And
yes, you mentioned Jevons' Law, I believe it was?
Yeah, Jevons' Paradox, that's it. Yeah, I mean, Jevons was an interesting guy. He was extremely insightful, I think a bit too serious for his own good. He died at a year early age, I think, because he stressed himself out worrying about things. But this very insightful comment about the introduction of the steam engine, James Watt's steam engine, in the late 1800s. And he was saying this was, you know, a major efficiency gain, and it led to increased coal consumption rather than less coal consumption. And he made a very emphatic argument that any argument to the contrary was completely wrong.
And as I learned from your website, your real specialty is clouds. And listeners, you can find that link, as I say, to Tim Garrett's website in the Radio EcoShock blog for February 4th, 2010. In my opinion, Tim, clouds are one of the last great frontiers of unknown science. Do you foresee a time when humans could control the clouds? And if so, should we?
There's actually a history to trying to control clouds. And even today, people try to engage in something called cloud seeding, where they tried to add silver iodide pellets to clouds in the attempt to accelerate their production of rain. Of course, this has agricultural benefits, and actually the field started with out of military interest. And it's been largely discredited simply because the amount of energy in a cloud is immense. It's something like many nuclear bombs going off at once. It's a huge amount of energy. You could power all of civilization if you could harness the energy off a few big clouds. So to imagine that we can control clouds seems a bit fanciful to me. And I know there are people who talk about it, but I'm highly skeptical.
Well, some have mentioned it as a form of geoengineering, as an alternative way to control the heat that reaches the Earth, but you don't really see a future for that in the near term.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my research is based on the ideas that these people are proposing, which are that if we add aerosol to clouds, then that will make them brighter and reflect more sunlight. And my belief is that we may make the cloud brighter here, but that would necessitate things becoming darker somewhere else, and that it would all be a wash once you consider the planet as a whole.
Right. Well, you know, Tim, I'm personally very resistant to recommending collapse as a solution. Billions of people would be hurt and likely many would die. And I'm enjoying our civilization, including talking to you right now long distance. So how do you personally handle the ugly possibility that we may be at peak wealth right now with a downhill ride ahead of us?
Yeah, well, I have two young children, so it's on my mind. Yeah, I mean, we're along for the ride. We will see what happens. And in the meantime, I guess I figure enjoy life while we can.
What are you working on now, and what would you like to research in the future?
Well, right now I'm about to submit a paper on how the Arctic becomes polluted and how clouds remove pollution from the Arctic. But I would like to pursue more of this research on the thermodynamics of complex systems. I've applied this to all of civilization, and right now I would like to use the same sort of framework to understand the development, growth, and death of clouds. I think the same principles can be applied, whether it's to civilization, to clouds, to a child, or whatever it is. We all live and die by the first and second laws of thermodynamics, so these principles should be quite general.
It might be interesting to apply it to cities as well, since most of us are living in cities and there are huge thermodynamic flows happening in cities themselves.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, that hasn't been done quite from a thermodynamic standpoint, but it has been from a mathematical standpoint. And in fact, when I mentioned earlier the concept of super exponential growth, there has been a recent paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy. Well, I guess it's a 2 or 3 years old now, that highlighted super exponential growth being one of the defining characteristics of successful cities.
Is there anything you'd like to add for our listeners as we wrap up here?
The main point from my perspective is that this is an interesting physics problem, and of course it has, you know, very personal aspects for all of us, but it's also interesting physics and it's fun to think about.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Tim Garrett from the University of Utah. Find this interview as a free MP3 download at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you, Tim. And I'm wondering, is it possible we could get together again sometime for a program on clouds themselves?
Of course.
I'd love to do that. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for being with us. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We've just heard Tim Garrett from the University of Utah, and let's take a quick review. His paper is titled, are there basic physical constraints on future anthropogenic emissions of carbon dioxide? The basic thesis, tested against past industrial development, is that neither population nor standard of living have to be included in modeling predictions of climate change. Garrett concludes that civilization, as measured by gross domestic product, is directly related to the amount of carbon burned. More emissions, more wealth. Less emissions, less economic production. Here is the exact description of the theory from an abstract of Garrett's paper. Quote, "Here it is shown, both theoretically and observationally, how the evolution of the human system can be considered from a surprisingly simple thermodynamic perspective, in which it is unnecessary to explicitly model two of the emissions drivers, population and standard of living. Specifically, the human system grows through a self-perpetuating feedback loop in which the consumption rate of primary energy resources stays tied to the historical accumulation of global economic production, or P times G, through a time-dependent factor of 9.7 plus or minus 3 milliwatts per inflation-adjusted 1990 U.S. dollar," end quote. Well, that sounds a little complicated, but, you know, the end result of it is, by applying his formula, Garrett says it would take a new nuclear plant built every single day to keep up our current standard of living. As that isn't happening, and may be impossible anyway, the only other solution is economic collapse. In our interview, Garrett suggests a horrible economic crash, which I imagine is diving perhaps to medieval standards of life, is required just to stay at 450 parts per million of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. In the conclusion of that paper, we find, quote, "Viewed from this perspective, civilization evolves in a spontaneous feedback loop, maintained only by energy consumption and incorporation of environmental matter. Because the current state of the system, by nature, is tied to its unchangeable past, it looks unlikely there will be any substantial near-term departure from recently observed acceleration in CO2 emission rates," end quote. And I'll let you get out of that what you can. Several science journalists picked up on the paper's underlying prediction, saying global warming is unstoppable unless the economic system crashes. And that leads to our next guest. He agrees and suggests it is our duty, all of us, to help the inevitable hard landing come sooner rather than later. Why wait until nature is totally used up on a nearly dead planet? What if civilization is a disease, fatal to life on Earth as we know it? That's the view of Britain's Keith Farnish, author of the book Time's Up, An Uncivilized Solution to a Global Crisis. You might not like what he has to say, or maybe you will. I'm Alex Smith, fearless host of Radio EcoShock. Keith, welcome to the program.
Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
Well, good. And I gather you tried Greenpeace for about 5 years, but got frustrated with that carousel of protests and then no real change.
Yes, there was only one action I ever did that was satisfying, and it was the only action that actually involved something really changing. The problem with most of the, and I'm not going to target Greenpeace in particular, only because I've got direct experience with them, but most of the mainstream environmental groups seem to think that you achieve change by going along with the status quo, by kowtowing to whatever system's in place. And of course you're going to achieve change relative to what's going on at the moment, but it's not significant. And if you, as we go on, I'm sure you'll realise that the kind of change that's required is certainly not the kind of change that groups like Greenpeace are looking forward to.
Well, you describe our current society as a culture of maximum harm. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I must admit that those aren't my personal words. I took them from the peerless Derek Jensen, who some of your listeners will be aware of. And Derek has written long time on the problems of civilization, particularly industrial civilization. The culture of maximum harm really is a way of describing how the system that we have tries to achieve its aims. And imagine that you're trying to get from one place to another. Most people would go from one place to another. They wouldn't really think about what they're damaging or the way that they're doing it in one particular way or another. The culture of maximum harm tries to achieve its journey by taking as much as it possibly can and by doing as much damage as it possibly can. And the reason it does this is because it has one primary goal, which is to achieve continuous growth. And that's economic growth in any terms of the phrase growth. And economic growth cannot be sustainable. So this culture, which I believe is unique in human history, is doing something that is uniquely destructive. In other words, it is the culture of maximum harm. It is the most harmful way that humans can exist.
One of your maxims is that corporations cannot be green. Why not?
A corporation, and this certainly does follow on from what I just said, a corporation exists in order to achieve economic growth. It exists in order to achieve profits. Worse than just an individual trying to make a bit of money, a corporation wants to ensure that it maximizes the amount of return for its shareholders. And in order to do that, it has to cause damage in some way. And it does that through a variety of methods. Either it keeps cutting corners, and those can be corners in environmental terms. So it could be ignoring environmental legislation, or it could be paying people as little as they possibly can, or it could be trying to do things as cheaply as possible in the dirtiest way possible, or it will try to make this profit by taking something that wasn't there in the first place. So, to take an oil company as an example, you can't make something from nothing, but if you have a source of energy underground, then effectively you're taking something from nothing. You're taking that oil, you're going to burn it up. The act of burning it up makes you money, and that is essentially how a corporation runs and makes its profit, by taking something that it didn't have to put back in. Its corporations are never going to be sustainable by their nature because of the way business operates.
You also dismiss governments as any part of the solution. Why do you think politics has become so irrelevant?
Well, it's a very sad tale, but I think it goes back to the history of empire, and the British Empire is a very good example of this. Empire has been always intrinsically tied up with trade. The British Empire was a trading body. It was so large because it reached out to as many places in the world as had things that it could take. So Britain essentially owned India, South Africa, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and many other territories. I think that's a good example of how governments are tied up with industry. If you listen to any politician give a speech of any length, you will always hear the word growth. You will always hear the word economy. And that is because the primary role of a government within industrial civilization is to keep the economy growing. It's essentially no different to a corporation. And it doesn't necessarily have to be there that way, but I don't believe that any government of any size exists in this society that isn't just like a corporation now.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We'll be right back with more from Keith Farnish, author of the controversial book, Time's Up. Are you ready to be uncivilized? Stay with us.